Welcome to the 60th episode of the Logan Bartlett Show. I am your host, Logan Bartlett, and what you're going to hear on this episode is something a little different. This is a conversation I've wanted to have for a long time with two of my partners, the senior most investors at our firm, Scott Rainey, as well as Satish Dharmaraj. Scott has been at Redpoint for a long time, making investments in notable companies like Twilio, HashiCorp, and Stripe, among a number of others. Satish is a former entrepreneur, having been backed by both Redpoint and Benchmark in his last business. He also has made investments in notable companies like Snowflake in the very, very early stages, as well as Zendesk, Sonos, Nextdoor, among a bunch of others. This was a really fun conversation to hear their perspectives on where everything's headed and the ecosystem as it stands, how our partnership works, and all of that. So thanks to them for finally coming on. They're both fairly press shy, and they haven't done any interviews in a long time. And so it took a lot of coaxing to get them on, but a really fun conversation. Before we get to that, please, whatever podcast platform you're listening to this on, give a 5-star review if you're enjoying what we're doing, as well as subscribing on YouTube. We're trying to get the counts up on both of those. It helps other people discover the podcast. And so that is really appreciated. But without further ado, my partners, Satish and Scott. I want you to know, neither of you guys have much stuff like out there. Neither of you have videos or anything. Satish, you have some from like a decade ago that I went back and watched last night. Okay. But like cumulative time that you guys have of things that I could prep, it was like maybe an hour and a half.
Hey, so before we start,
we've started, so.
Before we start with going down further, I'm really concerned here a little bit. About your performance.
Is this actually a performance review?
Yeah, this is, you know, I mean, I see you on Twitter fucking 24/7.
Yep.
I see you with all this podcast. I see you all doing all kinds of stuff. When do you fucking do work?
Yeah, like for instance, how many deals have you done in the last 12 months?
Zero.
Yeah. Doesn't surprise us.
Yeah.
Does not surprise us at all.
It depends on how you define
deals. I wouldn't be able to do any deal either if I was doing all the things you're
trying to become a media celebrity.
Instead of a rock star.
Really focusing on his job.
The good news in that is I think any deal that I would have done over the last year would be marked down significantly. So that's the way I justify
Isn't that the case with all the other deals you've done as well?
That's right. Yeah. That's not any different than 2 years prior.
What's different about that?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you guys doing this. I think this is our new studio thing in our office.
Mm-hmm. I like it.
We were not really nice. Using this space, so we actually turned it into something real. But I know I had to begrudgingly kind of pull teeth to get you guys to do this. So, and Satish didn't even realize we were actually recording here today. So.
I did not. I thought it was a prep meeting and I was going to talk to you about how it's a terrible idea to have me on a podcast.
No, it's great. You all your stuff that I was listening to is super interesting. But Satish, I wanted to start. I didn't know there was a bet among Zimbra employees that you weren't actually going to make it in venture.
That's correct.
Why? So Zimbra was your company you founded.
Yeah.
So you founded the business when?
2003,
raised money from Redpoint and Benchmark.
Benchmark. Yeah.
And
Excel.
And Excel. And ultimately sold it when?
2007.
For?
$350 million,
and you raised $25 million, so a good outcome.
Yeah.
And then you came over and worked here.
Yes.
And there was a bet among Zimbra employees that you weren't going to last?
Yes. In fact, Kevin Harvey, who's one of the founders of Benchmark, was one of the biggest kind of bettors saying that I won't make it in venture.
And why was that?
Because they thought I had no patience for it, that I would think it's a bunch of bullshit and walk away.
And all of that was true.
All of those are true, except that he didn't walk away.
He stuck with it. Yeah. Well, it is interesting. I mean, we see CEOs becoming venture investors, and you go from like the ability to have all ownership of everything to having no ownership of like anything with the companies, right? You're just like advising it. So was that a weird transition for you?
It's interesting. For me, the harder transition was not that. The harder transition was my own role inside of Redpoint, which is I have this theory that as you become better and better in managing people and trusting people to do their jobs, that as the CEO you say, okay, I'm going to hire the head of sales, and I'm going to trust the head of sales with her or his functional areas, and as you abstract yourself more and more, the next level of abstraction is away from being the CEO to like being a board member and then allowing the CEO to do their jobs. But I found it much more difficult inside of Redpoint because there is everything is, and when we came in, when I came in, there was like 10 partners, 10 MDs. And so everything is a group decision.
Yeah.
So everything from hiring someone to leasing a space or doing an event or anything like that or sponsoring an event, everything is like, okay, let's go talk to 10 people and have five people question you versus. So it was more of a challenge internally.
I'd say that a couple of things on that, though, that are really important to understand is Satish came on at a period of time when we were in the midst of a transition. We had had our founder group. And we were building out the next generation, of which I was one of those folks.
This was 2007?
2008, in that time frame. Satish joined as one of the next generation.
I joined 2009, folks. Yeah.
Nine,
yeah. And, you know, so we had a big group because we had like the previous generation and this upcoming next generation. As a result, as you go through that period of time, it actually is pretty challenging because you have a lot of people around the table. And, I'm incredibly thankful to our founders for the way that they handled that process and managed it. But so he's come on board was the single most important thing that's ever happened to Redpoint outside of its founding. And it was because he was who he is and because of the experience he had that he helped us basically question everything. And he didn't take status quo. He didn't take the status quo as acceptable. And he basically, in his way, in a way that only he can do it, challenged a lot of our assumptions and helped us step forward. I think if he'd come in and been like, oh, this is all stupid, we need to do it differently, there would have probably been some immunorejection. But Satish is such a lovable character and such a powerful leader that he's able to get everybody to kind of recognize we do need to step forward. We do need to progress. And it was really, really fun to watch. It was great for me because I was one of the people who had been on since 2000. And I wasn't able to affect some of those changes because I'd been the junior person who was kind of growing up into a position. He came on as, you know, one of the next generation people was actually able to make that happen. And I'm super thankful.
The structure of venture firms, as I think about it, there's kind of three models. One is like the partnership that we have, right? One is kind of the CEO or founder model that General Catalyst has and Sequoia has and Insight has and whatever. There's generally one leader at the top. And then there's kind of like the distributed P&L model to some extent where it's a holdco and then people kind of run their own individual businesses underneath it under a single umbrella. The hard part about the partnership model, which we have, is to your point, it is hard to make consensus decisions, right? And you're structured in a way that it's a great place to work, but doing office space or doing a website or hiring people and sponsoring.
Or deal decisions,
all those things. Like, how do you actually make those decisions? And so I guess what in doing that, like that process and that evolution was obviously there was a transition to a next generation that you guys were a part of. But did you restructure like how some of those things were actually made from a decisioning standpoint, either investment wise or whatever, all the other stuff wise?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, first couple of years, you know, things were pretty inefficient because we would have 10, 11 people making deal decisions. And honestly, they were suboptimal, as you would imagine.
Just because you go to the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, because, you know, we're in the business of taking risk. And every decision you make, you're making with imperfect data, with a lot of uncertainty around it. And so when you have 10 really, really, really smart people discussing it, you make average decisions.
And the cynic always sounds smartest, right?
Yes,
generally,
yes,
especially
yeah.
at
yeah.
the early
yeah.
stage.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. You do average deals that everyone is slightly comfortable with versus. And so Scotty and I came up with a structure where we had subgroups. So we had the infrastructure software subgroup that Scotty, me, John Velichka and Tim were part of, and then we had the consumer subgroup with which Chris Moore and Jeff Brody and Jeff Yang were part of, and so we started making decisions a little bit like what you were talking about in Battery, where there's a CEO for subgroup and you make that decision internally. So
yeah.
I think that helped a lot.
That helped on the investment decisioning
Correct.
Side. What about all the other stuff?
You know, I think what ended up happening there too is that we ended up just realizing that we could trust one another, and I think We started to try to encourage people to make decisions, and we would defer in many cases. And so we broke into these little committees in terms of how we think about operating the firm. you know, the back office stuff and all those things. And we started to push decisions down to those groups. If it was a really big decision, they'd come to the big group and say, I want to do this. Here's why. And, you know, for the most part, we would just defer.
That's kind of still how we are today.
It's
right?
Exactly.
Like, I'll do budget. I'll do founder experience. And come back together.
And this is an artifact of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's really important. I mean, one of the things that, you know, I had this epiphany at some point with the way that we were managing our firm, where we go to these board meetings with our startups and we tell them, you have to be lean, you have to be efficient, you have to be quick and nimble, make fast decisions.
Yeah, fire fast, hire fire fast. Fast.
And then I'd come back to Redpoint and I would think about how we were managing the firm on a day-to-day basis. And it was like being at a Fortune 500 company sometimes, it felt like, you know. And so we really needed to rethink that. And that all happened probably in the 2010, 11, 12 timeframe.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Where we started to try to act like a startup ourselves. And we're more like that now than ever. I mean, every year, I think we get more and more confidence in our ability to do this. And I think that we're as, you know, quick and nimble as we've ever been as a result. And it's really about, you know, agency and giving everybody the authority and ability to make decisions. So.
One thing I give the founding group a lot of credit for, and you all as well, as you took more and more of that mantle, though, is there's this... I sort of think about it as the Steve Jobs and the transition to John Sculley when you're with Apple. When you're not the founder of something, you can be paralyzed by the desire to drive on the down the road and not potentially veer off, right? And to some extent, to be able to continue to change and evolve, you have to be willing to take the autonomy to burn things down or take the risk that you might blow it up, right? And I give the founders a lot of credit for their willingness to step back and not sort of hang over our shoulders with the decisioning. And we were with them all yesterday, and they did a great job.
No, they're great at that. In fact, Timmy encourages that, you know, Tim Haley.
Tim Haley, who's been on Netflix's board for whatever, 30 years.
30
and
years.
One of the founders of the firm.
Continues to be on that board and one of the founders. And also my board member and, you know, at Zimbra and and OneBox, the company before then. So I have and he recruited me into Redpoint. Anyway, he, you know, I would go with them. I would go with all these issues. He would be like, just burn it down. That's your job, you know. So he would encourage that actively.
Yeah. And so was that something like as you guys, because I actually don't even really know this transition. So 2009, you came in, and then over some period of time, there was kind of this like recognition that there was going to be a new generation that sort of took over the two different groups. And was that sort of how it evolved over time? And you both are kind of the vestige of that prior group to some extent. If you go around our MD group, no one, I mean, you've been here the longest, and you're the ones with the most continuity.
The last two standing.
That's right.
For now.
Exactly.
Yeah. So was that something that was stated, or did it just end up happening that way?
No, it was definitely something that we worked towards. It wasn't like it just happened that way. We knew that we were going to do it, and Scotty and I had a conversation afterwards saying, okay, let's do a fun together, and then you focus on growth and I'll focus on early. So it was all explicit.
Yeah. And on the investment decisioning process, right, and the growth to early transition, so when did you all each start focusing? When did you move over to focusing really on early?
When Omega 4 was raised.
Omega 4. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was Omega 3, you were still sort of doing both.
Yes.
So
Does everybody know what Omega is?
Yeah, probably not. We use this term all the time. So Omega's our early growth fund that Scott and I are on the team for, along with our partners Elliot and Jason. And then the early team is Satish, Annie Kadavi, Alex Bard, and Erica Brescia. So that was an explicit decision that you guys kind of made early on, was you were going to divide and conquer in some ways.
Yeah, I think for a long time, we had operated both those funds with one single managing director group. But in reality, there are a few of us who spent a disproportionate time on the early growth side, and then the rest were spending most of their time on early. And that worked well for a while, but at some point when we realized we wanted to make investments to kind of strengthen each of those groups on an individual basis, we recognized that having one big group, it started to feel a little bit like what it did back in 2009, where we were having this big group, and you know, so we ended up separating the investment management committees and creating the two separate groups. Satish and I, even after during the middle of that transition, he and I had always spent about half and half our time on both, right? And we said we'll do one where we're still half and half, but then we're going to transition to where you'll do 100% of yours on early, and I'll do 100% of my time on early growth. And to kind of make that was the final step in that transition for us, kind of separating the investment management committees.
That happened Redpoint 7, and that what year was that?
Redpoint 7 is a 2018 vintage.
2018, fund. And then for us it happened to 2021, really. I mean, in practice, well, you started, I guess that was sort
it,
of...
It was really in the course of the previous fund. And obviously, you know, there were Tom and Alan who are our partners.
Sure. In terms of the actual investment decisioning and style, like early, you talk a lot about the consensus and the weighing down of the decisioning versus we try to be a little bit more consensus driven in our approach. Why do you think that works for early and maybe not for us?
Yeah, I think early is in many ways a bet on people and markets versus on. So it's more of an art and not a science. So there's no numbers. There's no, you know, churn numbers and revenue growth and KPIs. And so you had to make a more gut level decision. A lot of it is based on how amazing you think the founders are. That's a large portion of the bet. And then the second portion of the bet is how big is the market? Because obviously we want to have home runs, right? The power law works. And so those are the questions we're trying to ask. And that's a little bit more subjective.
Yeah.
Especially on the people side.
On the people
side. Market
side
can be a little bit more objective.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But given the level of risk that you're taking whenever you do a seed or series A, you know, getting consensus is really, really hard too. And if you are getting consensus, you just have to ask yourself, are we taking enough risk? Because the key to success of an early stage venture fund is really embracing the idea that we're really swinging for the fences.
And why do you think consensus works for us at the sort of slightly more growth stage?
Yeah, the thing, before I answer that, I'm going to say the one thing, even with us, ultimately in venture capital, it's about one person in the firm pounding the table and saying, I really, really want to be in this company, right? And I think in early stage, you have one or two people that feel that way, then, you know, what you have to do is if you've hired that person, they're in a position of trust and a senior leader of that firm, you basically need to defer to them. If that's what they want to do, you've hired them to do that, let them do it. For us, I think when you get to early growth, I think that there is some data. And so we need to agree on the fact base, is what I would say. And the consensus I think that we build is really around, do we agree on the fact base? What is working? What isn't working? There's always the challenge that we face, which is around, you kind of get pushed to the point of indifference on a lot of these deals based on pricing. And it's really about the level of conviction you have about how big this company can be, right? And even there, I think that there's not always consensus in our group, but there's generally a fair amount. But there still needs to be one or two people that say, I think it's going to be really big. And as a result, we should stretch and do it at the price that we need to do it at, right? So I think there's subtle differences, but I think that that's really what we mean by consensus.
Do you think people and markets are still what we're investing in, and it's just a slightly different consideration set of product market and things?
I think it's really important the way that we approach what we call early growth, and we always put this modifier early in front of it because it's not traditional growth.
Series B and Series C. For the
so these are companies that are just getting past some level of product market fit. Things are just starting to work. But there's still a ton of work to be done, right, in these companies. And so, you know, I think that we are taking a lot of risk. You know, and I think we're embracing more risk than a growth fund for sure. And as a result, you know, we have this decision process, which we call consensus, but it's still very much a leap of faith at some level. We have to be comfortable taking those risks if we want to deliver the kind of returns that we want to. Because we're trying to, in that fund, deliver early stage venture returns at this early growth stage.
Yeah. So. What about partnership dynamics? You guys are close friends, very different. You give each other, I think, an appropriate hard time that I certainly get a kick out of. What do you think about shaping different personalities within the group and how you try to make sure you have a different composition of types of people and leaders and all that?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Scotty and I, we go back literally 25 years because when I started my first company, OneBox, and then became an EIR, I was with Scotty at Redpoint. He would never do any work back then, just like now. That's when I started realizing what this venture capital job was all about.
But you can hang out.
I can just hang out.
Podcasting.
Podcasting,
memes. Yeah. Anyway, so we have like this deep trust that goes way beyond with time. And then the second thing is actually respect, right? You know, we both have been in the business a long time, and I respect his craft and he respect mine. And we have like this complementary skill set. When we're in the same team, we would always bounce each other off, and I would bounce off. Hey, you know, Scotty's one of the best. He can look at a company and give a great analysis of, you know, hey, here are the problems. I can look at people and do the same, right? Yeah. So there's that. And so when we started hiring people, and obviously the kinds of people you need at an early stage is different than the kinds of people you need in growth. But then we would always consult each other just to the baseline kind of metrics is, hey, is this person a good culture fit with this firm and can challenge and work alongside us in a way that is, you know, beneficial for the fund and the firm.
I amplify a couple of things. First of all, Satish, if you were to describe him, he's an instinctual investor. Like he knows probably within the first 5 minutes of a meeting whether or not he actually, you know, will want to invest in this company or not.
And we'll know too, by the way, based on the level of questions yeah. he's asking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like it's like that for Satish. Generally, for me, I'm way more analytical, and so I will think through things. I'll think through the pros and cons, and you know, my skill set, I think, as a result, I really love the early growth stuff because I think that applies. But it was awesome to have this combination where he could be instinctual, like his gut feel on teams and products and markets, and I could help think through maybe, hey, let's double click on this or double click on that. And it you know, that skill set is something that I think that together was great, but also it's reflective of the team that we built now, which is that combination of kind of instincts and, you know, people that have been on the front lines of building these businesses as operators, plus folks who have the ability to really think and break down businesses. But he said one thing that's important is like what hire for culture. And I think maybe we should define what that means.
Yeah.
And I think it's like, you know, first of all, Redpoint was founded by a group, three people from two different firms who came together to create Redpoint, and they were all friends. And the idea was that they would form a different type of fund, one that would work closely together. It wasn't going to be a collection of individuals going off in a bunch of different directions, but a team that would kind of approach investing and supporting our companies as a group, right? And so what do we look for? We look for people who think that way, right? We think for people who want to be a part of a team, who want to work with others. We look for people that are open and honest and transparent and also can accept that. So we can have very direct conversations here at Redpoint about how we feel about companies or decision-making or whatever. And we don't have to worry about hurting one another's feelings. We recognize that it's coming from a good place. It's open, honest. There's trust. And as a result, we can have really productive conversations that way. And then, you know, the last thing is we just want to hire really good people, like people that we really respect and like and believe are going to do the right things. And, you know, as a result, when you do all that, you put it together, what does that mean? It's a lot of fun to be here. It's an amazing set of folks who we are able to have a good time. I think we take the job very seriously, but we don't take ourselves very seriously, you know, kind of a low ego place like that.
As evidenced by Satish's sweatshirt.
Exactly. As evidenced by everything he does.
Yeah, Satish.
And so that's what's made it such a great place.
Yeah, but just one thing, as he was talking, I was reminded many, many times we used to have this office next to each other. I would walk into Scotty's office after a day meeting and say, your job is to convince me why I shouldn't do this deal. Yeah. And he has saved me many times on that.
What, are there any examples of, I don't know, Snowflake or an example of like a great success that was the right pairing of the two of you working together on? Is Snowflake the right one?
I think Snowflake is the right one, actually. It worked out. And it's always great. Hindsight is 2020, right? So it's great now to look back on it after it worked out and say, oh my God, we were geniuses to figure that out. But, you know, I met this deal on a Wednesday or something like that. And on Thursday, I talked to Scotty and said, hey, this is a cloud data warehouse building 100% in the cloud.
This is 2012. Right?
2013.
13. Mike Speiser from Sutter Hill
had incubated it.
They had come out of Oracle.
They had come out of Oracle. There were three engineers, and the product was still being built, which is a great stage for us. We want to do deals before the product is built. So the product was still being built, and it's a database product. So it's going to take a long time for it to be built. Then you got to figure out product market fit. So I was talking to Scotty, and we basically said, ah, that's data warehouses are big. They're big, big markets. Cloud, that transition is going to happen.
Redshift was the fastest growing business. And
yes, AWS Scotty had that data that he said, hey, from his, you know, he had done some work in that area and said Redshift is the fastest growing business inside of Amazon, inside of AWS. And so we're like, okay, that's a great market. Then we just fell in love with the founders. I mean, these three French engineers were like the best. I mean, top class, world class. And they were humbled, had a lot of humility, knew what they were talking about, had really, really strong opinions that they're not going to succumb to on-prem pressures and only build in the cloud. And so we liked all of that. And then we had already moved into the subgroup structure, so we didn't have to convince 10 people. So we had to convince the four of us, John, Timmy, Scotty, and I. So we made a game plan for the weekend and spent the weekend in their offices. And, you know, at dinner, we had dinner with them. By the end of dinner, we had taken the deal off the table.
All right, and this was a Sunday night, and they were supposed to have a bunch of partner meetings, right, the next day?
Yes, correct.
Was that consensus among the group at the time, or was that a controversial one among the subgroup?
Among the subgroup, it was totally consensual. Yeah. There was consensus. And then among the larger group, at that time, we've evolved to a place where we would go and say, hey, this subgroup has decided to do this deal. And everyone would say, okay, send me the deal memo. So, you know, Scotty, now's your chance to make fun of my deal memos.
Yeah, it didn't take them long to write it.
It's a one pager. Like, yeah, we should do this deal.
Crayon.
Yeah. Like a picture of a database, like, you know, the cylindrical things, and then we should do this deal.
Yeah.
And so we had a deal memo, and we just said, this weekend we executed on, we verbally agreed to a deal. And it was okay to do that back then.
Because the subgroup was signed up.
Because the subgroup had signed up. And there was a lot of consensus in that subgroup, but it wasn't a controversial
decision. Yeah, it was not controversial at all.
The group. I mean, I think it was... The only controversy on that one was that we didn't get to run our normal process, so that the full group didn't get a chance to
see it before it was done.
Before we did it, which was unusual. Yeah. But we all felt that strongly about it. And again, you know, we got to the point where we just were trusting one another to make those kinds of decisions. So.
One thing, I guess, Peter Fenton, when I spoke to him about when he made the transition from Excel to Benchmark, I forget, maybe it was Kevin Harvey or someone said, throw out all that prepared mind bullshit. Cause that was Excel's thing, is like, have a prepared mind and come in very prepared in the way you think about things. And I think Battery had a similar culture of like, let's go as deep as we can in individual sectors and make sure we know every single player that exists in the space. And to some extent, you need to play the game on the field as well and operate with imperfect information and be able to make decisions based on what's in front of you. Do you think, I guess in this case, in the Snowflake case, there were some elements of you had that data about Redshift, but at the end of the day, you had to make a decision based on what the game was.
I think it's really important. I mean, maybe it's this kind of a cop-out, but I would say that you want to be informed, right? You want to know what's going on in spaces. You want to know that Redshift is exploding within AWS and that, you know, cloud data warehouses have the chance to be a big thing. But on the other hand, I always feel like you go where the entrepreneurs are. Like, there's a reason that we're sitting in the seats that we are and entrepreneurs are out there doing it. They're much smarter, much more in depth, and understanding of the markets and the opportunities. And so we prepare ourselves in having great kind of purview and perspective on different categories and spaces. But in the end, I want to go where they are and where they tell me they're going. At that point in time, I want to have an open, fresh mind and perspective and lean into understanding that as best I can. But look, if I'm sitting there coming up with like, let's go find the companies that are doing this and doing that, there's some VCs who have been very, very successful doing that. But I think for me, there's a mass of entrepreneurs out there doing amazing things. I'd rather have them figure out where they want to go and us figure out whether or not we want to go with them.
I would say three things. One, he said, you know, entrepreneurs are smart. It doesn't take much to be smarter than Scotty, really.
No.
You know, so
yeah.
I just want to put it out there. Yeah. Fenton and Harvey and the story that's interesting, it just brought up my mind. They got to know each other at the Zimbra board.
Yeah, yeah.
It was interesting. Partway through Zimbra, Harvey hires Fenton. And he
Because Peter was at Excel and was on your board?
Yes.
And then Harvey was at Benchmark and on your board?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So they got to know each other at the Zebra board. And then one day Harvey calls me on a reference and he says, hey, this is going to be awkward. Yeah. But
who did they both stay on the board?
No. So Fenton, Axel had Teresa on the board after Fenton left. But back to the experts on Redshift and Snowflake, my big thing with the early stage team is to always say, do expert calls, but don't believe in them. I personally don't believe in expert calls, to be honest with you. I mean, Scotty's right. I mean, you got to have the info, but insofar as it shakes your conviction, that's the...
So whatever he's deciding the first 5 minutes of a meeting, he doesn't want any data that might come through.
That's what I'm hearing.
That is exactly what you're hearing.
But I will say, like, having looked at that next round of Snowflake, we went and I was at Battery at the time, but we did a ton of work, right? And there, you can talk to a lot of people that said, hey, this isn't smart. And we had a recent example with a company that we ended up investing in the Series C, but at the Series B, we talked to a lot of credible people that said, hey, we're going to fucking crush that, right? Yeah. And to some extent, if you get too close to the insiders, of course they're going to say that, right? It's like a defensive mechanism.
If you actually look at this, and I did write slightly more than one page after the Crayon thing, I had like two calls that I did. They were both advising us not to do Snowflake. They're like, hey, Redshift is already won, and they're going to run it over. And when Amazon finds a winning horse, they're going to back up their truck, and this is going to win.
Which was the sentiment for sure. There was a long period of time from like 2014 to 16 or 17 that was like, hey, you don't compete with Amazon. They're going to step on your throat technologically.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you see that reflected in the margins of that business at the early days. The gross margins of Snowflake were really low. I mean, the round that you looked at a battery would have been a challenging one to do because negative gross margins.
Negative gross margins, not a ton of customers at some step up in price. That was the one Altimeter ultimately ended up doing.
I think that one, that was Iconic, but
No, Iconic was after Altimeter. It was Altimeter then Iconic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know because I painfully remember. Well, you might have been involved in the company. I painfully remember each of them.
Losing to them?
I remember all the details around that. But what about pricing deals? Like how, at that point, that Snowflake round was 60
pre, we are raising 15. So, yeah, that was like a ridiculously expensive deal at that point because product is not built.
Pre-revenue,
pre-product. With three engineers and Mike Spicer's the acting CEO. But we had a lot of trust in Sutter and Spicer. Sutter and Spicer, the other thing is Mike Spicer and I go back a long way. We were both at Yahoo together. And so we entered the venture business at the same time. You know, we had done Pure Storage together. And so there was a lot of trust there too.
How do you think about pricing deals in general? And obviously it's different between early stage and growth stage, but... It's something we consider price, right? For sure. You can't not, especially at the stage we're investing in. But we also, this is one of the things I'm trying, at times I'll get caught up in is whether or not something makes sense as a deal, right? Yeah. And at the end of the day, I don't know if any of my investments have been right or wrong based on the deal pricing. And it's something that, and again, that's something you can say in a 10-year bull market or whatever we had for a long time. But how do you think about pricing of investments and like the importance of that?
I mean, you've heard me say this 1,000 times. And so I'll tell you one more time and you're going to roll your eyes. It's all about, for me, ultimately how big you think a company can be. Like how big the market is, how great the team is, how likely it is that you think that they can be successful. And ultimately, then working back from there. So if you think it can be a really, really big business, then you're going to think about it from like a dollar and dollar basis and work back from there in terms of just how far you think you can stretch, which is, you know, the exercise that we all have to go through for the most exciting companies. I, you know, when we get into a discussion internally about like at some price, you know, if it was 20% less, I think I might be interested. I'm always a little bit like, you know, that feels to me like you're just not that convicted that this is a deal we should do.
I've come around on that, by the way, when we saw just how multiples have gone crazy over the last 5 years. I'm not even sure what any company should be worth. It was for a long time worth, 15 times trailing revenue was normal. And then it went to 50 times trailing revenue. Then it went to 100. Now it's back down to 10 or something.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's so arbitrary, it feels like. But if something turns into Stripe, for example, or Snowflake or whatever it is, like it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Regardless of that.
Yeah. And I mean, think about the Stripe round we did. this is in 2011. This is before that. We were one of the co-leads on the Series B, Stripe, and that round was 500 pre. And that was, I mean...
Yeah, it was a crazy round.
It was an incredibly expensive round relative to where they were and you know, relative to every other
and
deal...
And a call
was,
option.
Every other deal that was getting done. And the way that was structured is we were investing some money up front, and then they had a call for additional capital.
Was it their option?
At the same price, but you know, basically they could take more. And, you know, I was just so convinced. I mean, this, you know, this is one of those meetings where you walk in, and I got a chance to meet Patrick Collison, and I remember just being completely annoyed in the conversation because at the time, I think he was probably 21, 22, and he was so much more sophisticated and thoughtful and experienced.
Back to what I was saying before.
Than Scotty. I was, yeah. And certainly more than Satish was, for sure. that, you know, I was just, and then I met, you know, John as well over breakfast. And same exact feeling. I was like, this is such a special team. And then you think about what they're trying to do and create they want to go after facilitating payments on the internet and ultimately how big you think that can be. It was just like, for me, the calculus was never based on what's the multiple and all that stuff. It's like, this is just going to be a really massive business and we should do whatever it takes to get in it. So,
what are the characteristics? I mean, you've been a founder, right? As you think about the successful founders you've worked with, what are the characteristics that you've seen in the, like, is there any commonalities between the different types or does it depend on the market or what are some of the non-negotiables for you with founders?
Well, definitely depends on the market. Everything has the context of the market behind it. Obviously, we hear about these stories where people pivot from, you know, like Slack is a great example, right? But you can't bet on that. So that is the context. Outside of that, I would say the biggest thing for me is, are the founders able to attract other great people and hire them and listen to them, you know? So those are two different things because, you know, if you hire them and you're still holding all the strings and you're not, you know, you gotta paint the vision, but have to let go of the execution, you know? So I think that's what, when we talk about people and, you know, we bet on people, it's like, hey, are these people that other people follow? That's the big question.
Yeah. What do you think? Like, what are you looking for? Are there any
I would say the same things for sure. I think that it's hard. You know, I get this question all the time, and I don't know. I know when I see it a little bit. It's like you just people that are kind of founders that are inclined to action, inclined to get things done, ability to recruit great teams, the ability to listen, you know, kind of willingness to listen, those kinds of things, insatiable appetite for knowledge. Folks that are, you know, some of the best founders that I've worked with are people, obviously, many of them have never been CEOs before. And it's like every time I get together with them, they've read another book on leadership. You know, it's like they just are.
There's that iterative learning element of it.
Exactly.
And it manifests itself. Ideally, you're seeing in other ways that they're reading books and continuing to get better, but also seeing it manifest in ways that they don't touch the same stove over and over again.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. And, you know, I think that the founders that I've worked with that have had the toughest time are the people that are a little static. You know, they just don't, it doesn't feel like they're growing as much as they might need to grow into that position. And so obviously our job then is to really try to help them grow. But, you know, the ones that seem to just understand that their job is about every month, their job is different than it was the month before. So they have to evolve and change are the ones that end up being the most successful.
By the way, I don't believe in books on leadership.
Yeah.
You don't?
No. You can't read. So that's
is that the
problem? There's that problem. Yeah, I can't read.
You don't believe in books and leadership?
No.
You think that leadership is purely like an innate thing?
It's a DNA thing.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
It's back to the instincts.
I know.
You either have leadership instincts or you don't.
You can become a better manager by reading books.
Okay, well, that's maybe
what
we're talking
about.
But you
can become a better leader.
Maybe that's what we're talking about here. Maybe it's books on management.
Yeah, you can learn to manage people better and all that, but I don't think leadership is that.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
What about...
Jack Welch is like a great manager, but like Martin Luther King is a great leader.
Interesting.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I don't know if those guys.
Yeah, I don't understand.
I kind of get what he's saying. Of Jack Welch is like he did a good job managing GE.
Yeah,
for a
I mean,
long
yeah,
time,
you look at your ops and KPIs and all that
so
stuff.
You're saying he wasn't a great leader?
I don't think he's a great. I would say he's not a great leader. Okay.
What would MLK have done with GE? That's what we really need to be answering.
Okay.
What about staying relevant in the industry. You guys are both obviously dinosaurs, but you've continued to stay relevant in the new trends and all of that. People will say this is a young man's game, and so that's maybe why you're dressed the way you are.
Yeah, but yeah.
How have you been able to like stay up on new trends and not actually, you know, calcify in what you learned?
I just tweet a lot, blog a lot, you know, go on podcasts and just be relevant.
That's the best way to learn. That's what I found.
Actually, the business is interesting as you stay in it for a long time and you work with a lot of different entrepreneurs and a lot of different management teams, right? I think then you build a reputation, good or bad, and then that basically flows around and that's how you become relevant. You know, you're talking to entrepreneurs and they come to you and they ask you. I mean, like just this morning, there was a deal that we did, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. And those guys are starting a new generative AI company. And they're like, hey, we wanted to call you guys first because we had a great, you know, experience working with you. So there's that. Obviously, we, you know, we're in the business, so we read a lot. And we hire young people who keep us honest and keep us in the flow.
Ride your coattails.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. But you're right. This is a young person's game.
I just think it's back to what we talked about. It's about being curious and, you know, constantly wanting to learn and grow. And I think, you know, many of the most successful venture capitalists are people that have done the same thing we just described about founders, is that they're never getting pigeonholed in one place. They're always kind of thinking about what's next and what's next. And I still get a real kick out of when we're finding a new area that we're excited about and really diving in and really trying to understand and learn as much as I can about that and meet as many entrepreneurs in that space as I can. I still get a real kick out of that. And and I think one of the things, though, is I don't think that the way that I went about building my venture capital career, I don't think that could be done again in this age. Because you've talked about me not being on podcasts, et cetera. I've never been interested in building a personal brand at all. I've actually always felt like at some level it was, I always wanted to be in the background because I think the founders and the entrepreneurs are the ones that we should be celebrating, right? But I think, you know, it's gotten to the point now where in so many cases where to build a career in venture, you really do have to build a personal brand because there's so much noise in this space that to get an entrepreneur to spend time with you, they have to understand who you are.
Yeah, right? It's interesting when people ask, like, how did you get into the industry? That's my version of this. And I'm like, oh, listen, I can tell you the story, but it's not particularly relevant. Like, those doors don't exist. Those doors are all shut. And they've been shut and they've been cemented over and they no longer look the exact way I did it. And you're going to have to find there's much different paths that you can get in. Yeah. People are much more accessible via, I don't know, tweeting or DMs or emails or podcasts or whatever it is. Like, there's much more knowledge out there, but it's not going to be the same way that you got in, that you got in, that I got
in. I look at the, you know, the people we hire now and you know, the way that they approach, you know, building
their
brands. It's, you know, it's important to do now. It's just, different than what it was like now.
I'm just sitting here getting so scared. I was just imagining how scary it would have been if you had to build your personal brand on the internet and everyone knew who you were.
I know. Like, maybe part of the reason I didn't do it is because I didn't want people to know.
Yeah.
There's literally like 9 minutes of Scott Rainey like on podcasts or videos out there. So we've now like tripled the amount of Scott Rainey out there.
And the reason I'm here, it's because you're sitting
there. I know. I appreciate you doing that. Another, I guess, thing that was enticing for me in coming over was it does have a the management company structure and how each entity set up is different than a lot of firms, right? And so we talked about the different structures between the partnership and the CEO model and the P&L model. We have a pretty clean and different structure than I think most have. And I think a lot of that credit goes back to the founding group to set it up that way. But Satish, do you want to talk a little bit about how we're actually structured?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, a lot of the credit goes back to the founders. But the way we are structured, well, the best way to explain this is the way most venture capital firms are structured is there's a management company, and each fund pays a tax to the management company in terms of carry. But we don't have that. You can think of us as, especially where the carry flows, each fund has its own carry. So there is no tax that you pay to the founders or other retired GPs in terms of carry every fund.
There's usually other firms will have multiple levels, and they'll say, hey, the founders get grandfathered into the economics over time, or they say, hey, the
20% of the carry goes to the management company.
And
the management company is owned by the founders or something like that. Here, two things. One is 100% of the carry flows to the fund managers. And second, equally important, is that we're an equal partnership, where if you're an MD in the fund, you're a GP in the fund, then you make as much money as the next GP next to you. That brings the team dynamic, which is part of our culture, into play, right?
Before we retire, you and I ought to think about forming a management company here.
I know.
That's right. Some people sell the management company.
Yeah.
You guys
let's do that, Scotty.
Yeah.
You can monetize it.
So whenever Logan stops tweeting and podcasting.
I'd love Logan to have to send me a tax.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Like, that'd be awesome. Why is that important? It's important because basically, as we talked about, being able to operate nimbly as an organization, this allows us to do that. Every fund is a separate company. Like, you literally restart Redpoint over every time we raise a fund. The economics are reallocated, and it means we can hire people in, and they're not paying a tax. But also, it allows us to kind of change on a dime. If we want to completely rethink the way that we operate, we can completely rethink the way that we operate. And we do that. You know, one of the first things we do is we sit down and say, okay, what do we want to do differently this time? And in fact, we bring people on, and I think you could probably saw this in your experience. I mean, the expectation not just is that you're going to have a voice. Our expectation is you're going to change it in some way. You know, and if you're not, then that's a problem. So I love it. I love that we kind of embrace that. I love that's who we are. When I retire, I'm going to wish that we'd done it differently. But I think it's really important. I think it's what's going to allow, it's allowed Redpoint to kind of make it through a generational transition, and what is going to allow Redpoint to thrive going forward.
You can't just bitch about stuff because you actually have to, you have the power to change things, right?
Yeah.
And so you can't just say,
A whiner.
Yeah, you can't be a whiner about it. It's like, well, go fix it. If you have a problem with it, do it.
And what are you going to do about it? That's basically what happens every time somebody raises an issue. The question back to them is, what are you going to do?
You're equally empowered. You're equally economically incentivized. So what are you going to do about it?
Yeah. It's a and it's one of those things that you think you want, and then you realize how much how much work it is to do. You know, it's a lot easier just to complain about things and not be able to enact change, but it is, it's empowering and unique. I do think the trends and stuff is an interesting component of it, right? And one of the things my entire career in venture has been mostly riding one-ish trend, which is cloud and software by and large, right? That's sort of the entirety of it. And that trend, to some extent, it became mainstream in 14, 15, 16, probably, like prior to the Snowflake investment. But along that way, it started to become pretty consensus. And now we're getting to the outer edges of like just playing the same hits over and over again. Right.
Yeah.
And so I've been hoping, and I think people have been hoping, that there would be a new trend. And to some extent, we tried to force feed crypto as an industry down people's throats of like, hey, here's the new thing out there, and we'll see.
Careful how you define we.
Yeah, there, well, we as an industry, as in Redpoint necessarily, but we as an industry tried to do that. We've talked about those trends though from a perspective. You guys have seen the internet thing happen, the mobile thing happen, the cloud thing happen, and now this AI one. And then you've seen the failed ones, the bots and the crypto. I mean, I don't know if we want to call that failed just yet, but. What are some of the other ones that have popped up?
Scotty has seen the abacus happen.
What is
abacus? The abacus? You know, you don't want to know what an abacus is. It's how we used to add before calculator.
All those really old trends. Where do you think? Where does your optimism sit on the AI stuff that we're seeing today? Kind of pop out
really, really high. But I think it's going to be like mobile, right? Which is everything is a mobile deal. When mobile first started, it was like, oh my God, mobile is going to be this. But mobile came into everything. And then data happened. Oh my God, data, you know, data startups. But all decisions are now driven by data. And I think generative AI is going to be the same thing, which is every company will have some component of generative AI. So first of all, it's going to become, you know, it's going to be part of every deal that everyone does and penetrate every industry. But is it going to be completely a new shift in everything that we imagine to have been true last year is completely changed now? Absolutely, yes. I think it's mind-blowing. I mean, if you saw the 30-minute GPT-4 demo yesterday, it's just mind-blowing. Things are going to be so different. We can't even imagine it.
So I think by mobile, what you're saying is like when 2007, 2008 happened, I became a mobile VC. And what that meant was like new companies basically.
He left his office.
Yeah, trying, exactly. New companies that were being started built walking. From the ground up, trying to take advantage of mobile data, right? And then the open platforms like the iPhone. And you know, we a whole bunch of companies were investing at that point in time that were kind of mobile-centric. And then before you know it, though, every existing company started introducing mobile as a part of it and it became an ingredient. But the reality is, you know, and I've heard that analogy played out. I've used it a lot of times. But now if we look back, mobile really did create a whole bunch of native new applications that were specific, you know, and it happened specifically because of mobile. And I believe the same thing's going to happen with AI.
What do you put on that, like Instagram?
Instagram.
And WhatsApp and Uber and Airbnb.
Exactly. And we can go down the list. I mean, you know, but all those things were created because of mobile. They weren't an outgrowth of, they weren't incumbent companies adding mobile, right? They happened because somebody looked at it and said, mobile's different enough that I can create an experience that isn't just an extension of something that's already happening,
yeah.
Right? And I believe the same thing's going to happen with AI. And I believe AI is as big as the mobile wave, for sure, in terms of what it's going to mean for value creation for founders and companies here over the next, hopefully, it's, you know, 10, 15 years, in the same way that mobile's kind of powered a lot of value creation. And I think that, you know, we're seeing all our companies add calls to OpenAI or ChatGPT or to GPT-3 or 4 or whatever. We're going to see all those things are going to be integrated into products to actually allow them take advantage of this. But I also believe that there's going to be, at some point, people are going to sit down and say, the way that we think about enterprise application software, maybe we need to rethink it from the ground up and start all over again, recognizing that AI is going to allow us to think very differently about what these experiences can be like for end users. And I'm excited about it because I think that if you think about cloud really started about 2007, 2008, when it really accelerated, AWS was a driver of that. But then, you know, that's when Salesforce and others started to demonstrate, hey, this people are going to consume, enterprises will consume cloud-based applications. Mobile happened at about the same time. For 15 years, we've been investing off of those waves. You know, even the data stuff we're doing is really an outgrowth of the move to the cloud, right? And it was getting harder and harder for us to find things that we felt like had a lot of running room that could be, had unbounded upside because those themes had, they were starting to get a little bit long in the tooth. And I think AI has the ability to be this thing that is the wind in our sails here for a long period of time.
Yeah, that's the way I've sort of thought is that the internet changed every business, like totally. It changed the venture capital business quite literally. We had to have a website, right? And it changed restaurants around the corner. And this feels closer to mobile in the sense that maybe it's and the equity value created there was tons of net new stuff.
Yeah.
Mobile didn't change every single business, right? We didn't need a mobile app in the same way. It changed how we operate internally, but not how we necessarily go to market as Redpoint. But it did create a lot of independent equity value. It also created a bunch to the, you know, the big incumbents as well. But it's interesting to hear how many people are that were cynical of crypto are now optimistic of AI.
I just well, so you can see real world applications right in front of you. And the ability to kind of monetize. And I do think mobiles, I think what's happened is the iPhone has just plopped in everybody's lap over the last couple months, right? It's literally that big of an event. If you think back when the iPhone was introduced, that's just kind of fallen in everyone's lap here. And now, you know, we've got this blank canvas to think about what we do with it. And it's going to be really exciting to see.
Not just that, if you, with ChatGPT, you can go to any other person and explain what it is and show them a demo and they get it and they can go explain it to someone else. You could never do that with crypto.
And how do you think he's writing his deal memos now?
Yeah, exactly. Now they've gotten a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like they're now a page and a half long.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. And he's got like really real graphics and drawings in there now. It's really amazing.
Excellent. What about the fun,
Midjourney, baby?
What about the fun dynamics like in the industry as well? So now we have these big trends and we've seen funds grow. I mean, you joined Redpoint in 2000. So you saw the tail end of funds growing. Yeah. Was that the peak of the
Yeah, I joined the venture capital industry the day the Nasdaq peaked.
Okay. So, and it took and another 15
ever
years.
Ever since
or
Scotty joined.
I know. Well, it came back. There were 5 years, whatever, 2016 to 2021 that I kept going up. And then I started going back down again. But we've had a proliferation of funds. We've had a proliferation of tourists kind of entering the industry. We've had the solo VCs and all of that stuff. Now it feels like we're going back the other way a little bit. But we've generally tried to stay smaller than certainly our peers that have been around for as long of time and with some of the same companies that we're in as well. How do you guys think about fund composition and the state of the industry now?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, honestly, is institutional knowledge and history that I frankly benefited from. I think during the dot-com days, we Redpoint, raised all these big funds and realized that, hey, that's not how we make a great multiple on funds. And what we really want to focus on is a multiple on the fund. And if you want to make a 10x fund or a 15x fund, you know, you got to have a small-sized fund, not a big-sized fund. And I think that institutional knowledge has been hammered into our heads from the dot-com days that, you know, that, and which then I inherited. And so we always think about it from, hey, fund-on-fund multiples. The math just doesn't work when you have that big a fund to create a 10x fund or, outlier funds.
Yeah, and I'll put a fine point. I mean, the last 3 to 4 years, we've seen a lot of really gross behavior. You know, just these massive funds being raised and people investing them over the course of a year, clearly chasing FOMO, enabling, a lot of bad behavior. Frankly, it's hard for me to sit here and say, hey, giving founders a lot of money at high valuation is a bad thing. But the bottom line is, I think we're seeing that it wasn't a great thing for these companies right now. A lot of companies are having to go back and actually think about how we really build the business and make sure we're building a good business, one that'll has the ability to be efficient, where we can't just use money to kind of plaster over all the things that everybody has to do when you go through building companies. So, I worry about the industry. I worry about all that money sitting out there. A lot of it still is. We still have a lot of folks out there that I don't think about the long game as investors who are, I think, focused very much on trying to make a quick buck and not really about company building, but really about how do I put as much money to work in a shorter period of time to generate as big a return as I can. And I certainly hope that what happens over the next few years is a lot of that goes away. I certainly don't want to get to the point where companies can't raise the money they need to be successful, but I'd like us to get to the point where, the dynamics in this industry are one that are really focused on, let's build really great companies and everything else will work out from there.
We gave money back, right, in Redpoint 2. Excel did, Battery did. There was a handful of firms that did as well. Do you think that's something we're going to see, or
we already did see it, right? Didn't
I guess Founders Fund did the cutover. Yeah.
Yeah.
They shortened their early stage. The exact way they did it, I think, was they had raised like 1.9 or something, and then they said, we're going to cut it actually at 900 and then roll over that next billion to the next fund in some way. So it was a little different, but similar idea.
It might happen. It might happen. I don't think it'll happen quickly. I think part of the problems is these firms hire a lot of people, have an expense structure that makes it difficult to do that right out of the gate. And, I've heard stories on the opposite side, and I think we've talked about this, with where people post the market correction, firms going out raising really, really big funds, very, very large funds, not getting all the way to this massive target they had. And instead of saying, we've got a really big fund now that looks great and we're going to be able to deliver a really good return, we're going to keep fighting until we get that extra $1 billion into our fund, because every fund needs to be bigger than last, because that's the way that we operate. And I think that is such a distorted way of looking at the world. I think it's such a cynical way of thinking about our industry and about what we're trying to do here. And, I think it's greed, honestly, greed and ego, personally.
So that's the element of the industry as it stands with these big funds and the deals and all that. I do think the pendulum swung back from we've seen founders had all the power in all these rounds, right, where they were getting multiple term sheets. And now it's a little bit more of a healthy balance where for the most part, people aren't giving large secondaries to founders to try to get into deals and all that. We did, I guess we're recording this a week after all the SVB stuff played out, right? What about the implications for, either with regard to how different people acted in sort of a zero-sum way, maybe on Thursday of pulling money out, or how different people acted very publicly in what might have been somewhat inciting of other bank runs that we potentially saw on social media over the weekend. I know you guys don't spend as much time on social media as I do, but I will say the sentiment on venture capital, it feels like kind of took a lot of political goodwill was spent over the course of the weekend, right? And I think there's been a lot of good work that the industry's done that we haven't done maybe as good of a job as we should have of getting the message out of things like Moderna and how big of a impactful institution that was over the course of the last couple of years. Or some of these other, I mean, Zoom, quite literally, like venture-backed startup, changed the way we process the
pandemic. And saved us during the pandemic.
Saved us during the pandemic. And so I think there's some branding issues that exist with venture capital. And 100%. I do feel that we're moving in a direction, if we don't figure out how to push back, that there's this social like pariah. Someone wrote an article calling VCs parasites that was run the other day and recommending euthanasia, which I'm told was a Keynes economist reference and not a actually recommending death.
I think he was
capitalist.
Really talking mostly about VCs that do a lot of tweeting and
meetings. Yeah, that's right. I think honestly, specifically me, especially. Yeah. But what do you think about that? I mean, we're in more of the spotlight than we've ever been. And we've obviously embraced it in different ways, you guys less so than I.
We have done a really, really poor job so far of bringing out all the good things that tech and venture capital and innovation and entrepreneurship, jobs. I mean, like if you're an Uber driver or DoorDash driver or Instacart delivery, you know, there's so many hourly jobs. All of them are powered by the innovation that happens in the Valley. And we realized we have no friends on the left, no friends on the right. You know, we are a pariah, and we got to do a better job of blowing our own trumpets a little bit and talking about the values that we bring and the value that we bring better and honestly have better connections in D.C. and things like that, which we didn't have. And a band of VCs came together, as you know, and we started tweeting together, and a lot of great firms, GPs from a lot of great firms. And one of the things that we're thinking about is, hey, how do we affect this thing that you're talking about, and how could we be better understood, honestly?
And it's not just venture, too, right? I mean, to some extent, like Elon Musk or whatever, some of the big personalities in tech can come across as assholes.
Well, I think that's one of the things I was just going to say is I hope part of what happens here is that we as an industry take a step back and make sure that we're behaving in a way that actually warrants us being given the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, I'm not sure that we always do. So I think there's hopefully a little bit of introspection that happens post this too to help us understand how to make sure that we can rebuild the political capital that I think that this industry deserves. It's not just venture capital. I mean, I think when we talk about VC, I mean, really what we're here to do is to help these founders and these entrepreneurs succeed, right? And if we're not here, it's very difficult. If venture capital doesn't exist, it's very difficult for that innovation to happen. But that's ultimately what we're in the job of doing. And I think, you know, as long as we don't lose sight of the fact that really our job is to make them successful, then I think we're going to be in good shape. So I have a question for you.
Yeah, give it to me.
All right, so you're of a different generation than the two of us. I'm curious how you think the differences between the way that you see the venture ecosystem, you see the future of venture capital, and maybe the way that Satish and I see it from our standpoint. Do you think that there's a do you think it's different? Do you see it differently?
I think that a lot of the trends that we saw over the course of 2020 and 2021, there was we saw when we talked to our LPs or talked to people in the ecosystem, there was clearly this mindset that we were shifting to a haves and have nots, and you needed to get big and you needed to have a single platform and a whole bunch of services. And I think it was kind of Andreessen Horowitz kind of led this one end of the spectrum, right? Or you needed to be really small and really specialized on the other end of the spectrum. And when you haven't been in the industry as long as you all had been, and you just hear that from everyone, it makes sense, right? Like that's the way the banks played out. That's the way, Hollywood agencies played out. And it makes sense that is a way that things kind of polarize in some ways. And so I think I always had in the back of my head, well, maybe that's right. Like maybe that we should move in one of those two directions, either get bigger or get smaller. And left to my own devices, I wonder if I would have been as disciplined in our approach or what made us special. And would I have chased that shiny object a little bit more? I think now it's become obvious that that isn't the case or isn't the case in the near term. And so I appreciate you guys keeping me and us in line and like consistent with our knitting around time diversification and moderate fund sizes in the grand scheme of things compared to other people. So I think all of that is something that I don't know if I ever went full on in that direction that I actually truly believed it, but it was always rattling around in my head. And I think both of you kind of kept me consistent or kept me from jumping further in that direction, in that line of thinking. Otherwise, I think there is this element of craftsmanship to the industry that still exists with founders and the ability to work with them and partner with them and that enjoyment of it. And I think we've definitely seen more and more finance people just purely get into the industry, and having grown up in finance, like I certainly recognize that there is still this artisanal quality of helping founders. And I think that's a real tension that sort of exists within my generation a little bit, as how much are we partners to founders and helping them shape their business versus pure capitalists, and we're just a earlier stage hedge fund in some ways. And so I think that's a tension that our industry wrestles with in some ways. And I think we're going to continue to wrestle with the artisanal versus the pure capitalist quality of all of it. And one of the ways I've heard it, I think Ben Thompson talked about venture capital being an iterative game in a lot of ways, right? In that you're not just solving for the near-term solution to any problem. You're sort of playing an iterative game that adds up over time. And so it doesn't make sense to make a zero-sum decision along the way. I think as more and more finance people have entered the industry, we are seeing more and more zero-sum and less iterative game mindset around this. And so I don't know what the big implications for that are, but it could be, I mean, you're seeing elements of the fee chasing and the all, like, the industry looks different than it did 10 years ago, and I think it's going to look different in the future, maybe not for better.
Maybe that's some of the things I've alluded to in our conversation today, like that feel like the old guy saying, kid, get off my lawn here. But I do feel like we've moved away. We've lost sight of what we really all are about as an industry. We're really about helping entrepreneurs do amazing things, which is build companies. It's the hardest job in the world. And you know, figuring out how to help them and being focused as a group on as that is your primary goal. And it does feel like there's so many people in the industry which have lost sight of that. They really are just about how do I get all this money to work and generate as big a return as I can. And I certainly hope a part of the outgrowth of what's happened over the last couple of years is we moved to in a direction where people get back to, you know, the core fundamentals of like just being focused on helping build great companies.
Tell me if I'm wrong, but a lot of the stuff played out in 2000 to 2001 probably similarly, and then it retrenched and went back to...
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of like... that happened in such a condensed period of time. This happened over you know, there was like a 15-year bull run, right, that just kept adding on and adding on. That happened in a relative, you know, from 97 to 2000, 2001, right? And there were a lot of tourists who came in but didn't have a chance to really kind of infect the industry in the same way. And they definitely left. And, you know, we were back to kind of square one, right, and kind of building up from there. This time, since it's happened over a longer period of time, it has changed the industry in a more fundamental way. And, you know, I don't think we'll ever get back to where we were. And we probably shouldn't, because, you know, we could talk about what's changed in the venture industry over that time. But one of the things that's happened is obviously this is a much bigger industry than it was in the time that, you know, in 2000 when the internet bubble happened. That felt like we were the center of the universe. But, it, you know, it's, you could see those stats, like how many of the top 10 most valued companies were tech companies back there. It was maybe one or two. Now it's probably 8 or 9. Right. Yeah. And the industry's grown up. It's definitely matured. It's massive. And as a result, you know, obviously, venture capital is going to change. It's going to evolve with it. But, you know, maybe it's changed in ways that some ways I think we need to get back to basics.
Logan, I have a question for you.
Yeah, give it to me.
Who is your favorite partner at Redpoint?
Besides you guys or including you
guys? No, just pick one.
pick one?
Including us, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
It's so hard. How do you pick between your mother and your father?
How do you define favorite?
I'll let you guys decide which one to use my mother, which one's my father.
You're an entrepreneur. You have to pick someone to be on your board. Who are you picking? Come on, man.
These are the hard questions that I think you don't have to answer.
Yeah. He doesn't want to answer here because it would be Annie or Eric or somebody like that.
Exactly.
Who has the best hair? That's me. Right?
I think that's you. I would give that to you for sure.
What am I missing?
Dude.
Yeah, your eyebrows are amazing.
Glistening.
So that'll do it for the 60th episode of the Logan Bartlett Show. Thank you to Satish and Scott for finally coming on. Thank you to Rashad and Justin for their efforts with this episode. And thank you everyone for listening in. Fun episode to finally do something a little bit different with a look inside our partnership. We look forward to seeing everyone back here next week on the 61st episode of the Logan Bartlett Show. Have a good weekend, everyone.